comes, as I think has been said already, from a very deep desire among members of the House of Bishops, the overwhelming majority of members of the House, that this measure to allow women leaders should pass and pass on. And on my own part, that rests on the conviction that, as I think I said at a meeting in Ludlow Palace last year, we need a deepening, enriching, and, yes, humanizing presence of women in the House of Bishops and in the Church more widely in this industry. And we need it urgently. And nothing has made me think yet about that conviction, that theological conviction. I hope and pray to, as do, I believe, all the members of the House of Bishops, that when this legislation is passed, it will feel like something that the Church of England can celebrate together, something which is, as the Archdeacon just said, good news for all, a true witness to Jesus Christ in the world. So why have the bishops done what they have done? Why have they, to use one phrase that's been about destabilized the process? The bishops were persuaded, that is the majority who voted for this amendment, the bishops were persuaded that two particular problems remain. And I want to suggest that the debate today is not just about precise wording of the proposed amendment, if I can see, but about whether the bishop's diagnosis is right, that there is some unfinished business here. Much of the reaction in recent weeks has apparently assumed that the measure was as good as it could be, and that it was pretty much assured of passage prior to the amendments being proposed. The majority of the bishops in the House were not convinced of this, despite the heroic efforts of the original committee and the steering committee, to which I want to pay tribute. And they were not convinced, not simply because they had been got at, because they had been intensively pressurized by one or another group, but in large part because of their reading of their own diocese's situations, and indeed of the views of their diocesan representatives in Synod. So what are the problems? What was the diagnosis? First of all, there was the sheer pragmatic uncertainty about the passage of the measure, based on an analysis of patterns of Synod voting and what people knew of their diocesan situations. Given that, it's not wholly surprising that if one adjustment would increase the chance of the measure passing, it is going to be very attractive, especially given that theological conviction is already mentioned in the measure. And what was proposed was seen, to Boris Mulder, as well as spelling out implicitly, and spelling out explicitly what was already there implicitly, in a way that would give a required minimum of assurance to those with abiding reservations. That was one bit of the diagnosis. The second, though, is a little more complex, and I do urge you to give some thought to this. In the existing 2.1 of the measure, there is no reference to the theological conviction or anything else about the male bishop. And the worry that some people have had is the lack of any wording beyond that simple male bishop phrase risks something quite serious. It risks suggesting that because no other criterion of maleness are mentioned there, suggesting that any criterion other than maleness is irrelevant, it risks suggesting that what we are accommodating in this is sheer unwillingness to see a woman in the Episcopal ministry. In other words, it risks accommodating precisely the kind of misogyny that I hope the Synod would have no time for. It is accommodating what we ought not to accommodate. The amendment proposed seeks to address that worry, which I have to say is a real concern of my own. I appreciate that this argument cuts no ice with those who don't think that there is anyway any legitimate theological ground